You'll take your Bibles with me this morning and turn again to the Gospel of Mark. Mark, and we're toward the end of chapter 14. All right. Mark and chapter 14. And at verse 53, we'll read it in just a moment. About a month ago, I had to get online for a virtual appointment that I had. As the lawyers from one representing me, what's he doing preaching? And the other one representing, well, I'm being represented by an ICBC attorney. And the other one by her own attorney, and I won't get into details, only that 6 years ago, I rear-ended another car. I won't get into details, you can ask me later. It's coming on 6 years now. And I guess that never got settled with respect to an injury claim, and so time has marched on so that we finally had discovery about a month ago. The trial, if all continues on, is scheduled for January of 2025, which I think will be almost 7 years since the accident actually happened. But aside from that, the point being is I had to get on and online and I had to testify. I had to give my account of what happened in this motor vehicle accident. And thus, this may be headed toward trial. There is a procedure that is put in place for these kinds of things to sort themselves out. And that's why we have insurance and everything like that. Now, I may have to testify in court, I'm not sure, but I have testified in court before. I don't know if I ever shared this story. It was in 1980. I was on Hastings in Vancouver in Gastown. I was parked off to the light and I got banged from the back. Accident also ended up in court because the person who rear-ended me was charged with impaired driving. He was somewhat impaired, and the judge actually chuckled a little bit in court when he asked me what he had said, and I said, he said, "You got a brand new Sonda Hivic here, huh?" So anyway, that was my first guess that there was something not quite right. And there I had to testify. It was actually quite a famous person who did this. You can ask me later. I think he's passed away since then now, but you can ask me later who that might have been. Now, we can say that there are all kinds of inadequacies in our justice system. And I would be the first to point things out. But it's nothing compared to some of the countries around the world and the justice as we find it this morning in Mark chapter 14. We have a name for these kinds of tribunals. Anybody care to guess? Yeah, that's right. It's called a kangaroo court. I don't know how the kangaroos got so defamed by the way we do things, but the kangaroo court. Well, this morning we come to such a trial. It's a classic example of a kangaroo court jamming through a conviction that should never have been. It reminds me of a Netflix show I watched of a convicted offender who actually was falsely convicted twice, and he spent decades in prison. It's a very fascinating story. This, though, takes the cake. We left off last time with Jesus being apprehended in the Garden of Gethsemane, just at the foot of the Mount of Olives. This is the place where Judas betrayed him with a kiss. Peter cuts off the servant's ear, which Jesus heals. And then Jesus is seized by a regiment of soldiers, and his disciples flee. We are left off with a very interesting case of the very first streaker in human history, that taking place in the Garden of Gethsemane, as he fled with, you can read it for yourself. We pick up the story at verse 53, reading down to chapter 15 and verse 15 in a message I am simply entitling, Crucify Him. Crucify Him. Mark 14, 53. And they led Jesus to the high priest from the garden, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. And Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death. But they found none, for many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Not even about this their testimony, yet even about this their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, What further witness do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, Prophesy! And the guards received him with blows. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, You also were with the Nazarene Jesus. But he denied it, saying, I neither know nor understand what you mean. And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him and began again to say to the bystanders, This man is one of them. But again he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. And immediately the rooster crowed a second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he broke down and wept. And as soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. And Pilate asked him, Are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him, You have said so. And the chief priests accused him of many things. And Pilate again asked him, Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you. But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Now at the feast he used to release for them one prisoner from for whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. And he answered them, saying, Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews? For he had perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him released for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews?" And they cried out again, "Crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Why, what evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas. And having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. There's a kangaroo court. I want to have you see three scenes featuring three individuals, three key persons outside of Jesus in this morning's text. First of all, I would have you see the spiteful priest who damns him. The spiteful priest who damns him. I was thinking, do I use the word damn? That's pretty out there. And I tried a bunch of other words. Derided him. You know, you need a D word, but that's best. They damn him. You'll see why in just a moment. I would have you note three things here. First of all, the location for the trial. The location for the trial. Verses 53 and 54. Right away, and I'm going to talk about a number of illegalities that took place during this trial of Jesus, but right off the top, we have our first. Jesus is taken, it says, to the home of the high priest. His name is Caiaphas. And there took place a meeting of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin being the ruling group of 70 or 71 individuals, 70 plus the high priest, I believe, who were looking after this whole affair. They wanted Jesus dead, and now they had him. Last part of verse 53, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes representing the Sanhedrin were there. They met together. They now have Jesus. They have arrested him and now are going to try him privately in the middle of the night at the home or the residence of Caiaphas, who is the high priest. He's the numero uno among the religious leaders in Israel. Problem number one, the Jewish law did not permit trials to take place in the high priest's residence. There was another place that they typically met for their business. This was not it, but it was convenient, it was private, so that's where they convened. Now, Mark is very selective. If you go to the other gospel accounts, there's a whole list of other details that are part of this story that Mark does not refer to. So we're not going to run and chase all of these except in a few instances. You can read them for yourself as they all have various views on what took place at the trial. The first thing that Mark does not include is the preliminary hearing before the high priest. He's also called Annas. Annas is the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest but had been deposed by the Romans but still had significant authority among the Jewish leadership. So they go to Annas first, then to Caiaphas. Mark does not discuss that. That's in another gospel. John 18, to be specific. Verse 54, Peter is lurking on the fringes, and he will come into focus in just a little bit. He eventually makes his way to the location after fleeing from Jesus in the garden. But he probably then, you know, kept himself at a safe distance, and Peter's Peter. He's got to know what's going on. What's going to happen here? Oh, Peter. He gets into the courtyard and he sits with the guards who are warming themselves around a fire to keep warm. It is early spring. The nights can be cool in Jerusalem at that time of the year, Jerusalem being some 2,500 feet in elevation. And so there is Peter warming himself. The location for the trial. Two, we have the fabrication of the testimony. The fabrication of the testimony. So the trial begins, verse 55. Again, as I've mentioned, it was illegal on so many fronts. Let me read. In capital cases, a verdict of guilty required a second sitting the following day. Didn't happen. Both sittings had to take place during daytime. Didn't happen. When did this take place? In the middle of the night. And neither on the eve of a Sabbath or a festival. This is on the eve of Passover. Witnesses were to be warned against rumor and hearsay. What do we have here? False witnesses arranged by the court itself. A charge of blasphemy could not be sustained unless the accused cursed God's name itself, which he didn't do, in which case the punishment prescribed was death by stoning, which did not happen, with the corpse then hung from a tree. The chambers of the Sanhedrin were the hall of hewn stones in the temple. There is no evidence that the Sanhedrin ever met formally in the house of the high priest, as I've mentioned. Nearly every detail of Jesus' trial violates the rules for capital cases prescribed in the Mishnah, which is a Jewish commentary on the law. The Sanhedrin short-circuited procedures and contravened the law egregiously at points in order to expedite Jesus' execution. That's just a summary of what took place here. You see, when you want to do something bad enough, who cares about the law? Those are just technicalities that get in the way. But the law was there for a reason, to give a fair trial. This trial was anything but fair. So that up front. And so they recruit, it says here as we continue in the story, some witnesses, and I put witnesses in quotation marks, people who, you know, then we do the same in court. We have, you know, at least they do on Law and Order. You know, they get people up there and then they give their testimony with respect to what they saw or some of their expert testimony. And so they have witnesses here testifying against Jesus. Again, I would remind you, it's in the middle of the night. How do you get witnesses at 2 a.m.? Unless it's set up that they happen to be there. Right? This is not something that's prearranged. It is prearranged, but it's all predetermined. So they have these witnesses in the middle of the night. Now, the law required two corroborating witnesses to convict a person in a capital case. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 6, in case you don't believe me. Deuteronomy 17, 6. On the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. So you need at least two witnesses saying the same thing in order to have a criminal conviction leading to execution take place. Very clear according to the Old Testament law. Do we have that? No. You have these witnesses, they're testifying, but they can't get their stories straight. They're saying all different kinds of things, but they're not agreeing, it says. This is a charade. Verses 57 and 58, we have one example of this. And some stood up and bore witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.'" Well, as with all testimony that's false, it's not completely wrong, but it's not totally true. It's in the details that we discern guilt from innocence. They said, "Yeah, he said he was going to knock the temple down. He's going to bring his crew in there and destroy the temple, and then he was going to rebuild it in 3 days miraculously." Well, he had said something similar. John chapter 2, 19 and 20. Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Okay, that's all he says. Now, he obviously had spiritual meaning to it, but they interpreted it physically, and they add some things to. But even then, it says their testimony did not agree. They all added different things. No, he said, no, this. Each of their citations was a bit different. You see, they were not interested in truth. They just wanted to get rid of him. That is a great illustration of the world today in the West and Christianity. Increasingly, we don't. It's not the truth. It's not trying to find the facts. It's just inconvenient. We'll talk about that at the end. Just want to get rid of Jesus and his followers. Brother Marco informed me a few weeks ago that he was listening to a talk show. No, it was preaching, ministry. And it doesn't matter who the speaker was, but a good speaker on the radio. But it was announced that they were substituting another program from him to be aired in its place. And if you wanted to listen to that, you could go online. And my understanding was it was because what was being aired was not legally to be aired in Canada. It was a sermon out of Romans 1. God gave them over. It's beginning. You're not allowed. We're pushing this out. It's not logical. It's even against the charter. It's against law, but it doesn't matter. We want to get rid of it. And Jesus said, "If they hated me, they'll hate you too." Starting. I don't know how much longer I'm allowed to be able to read some portions of the scriptures. That Romans 1 will be illegal. It'll be hate speech. Okay? That's some loose application here, but Jesus riles people up against him, saying things, we'll talk about it in just a moment, that people don't want to hear. So he's completely misquoted, he's misinterpreted, he's misunderstood. He was speaking in spiritual language, but they twisted it to make him say that he was going to destroy the temple. But again, they didn't agree with themselves. To this day, along this line of thought, people get Jesus wrong. Misquote it, the scriptures, misunderstand it, misunderstand him, misunderstand us. That continues. Some of that in theological circles, some of that in the secular circles. He didn't claim to be God. If you're Jehovah's Witness, you don't believe he was God. He was just a great prophet. So say the Muslims. Oh, but your friends, those are religions, but your friends might say, he said we're not supposed to judge. Yeah, but that's twisted. He lived his life primarily as an example to teach us how to live. Well, he did that, but that wasn't his primary reason for coming. The main thing is that we love, read, accept each other. That's what it was all about. Mary Magdalene was his mistress. I forget the name of the book, Dan Brown. He died to show us that non-resistance is the divine way. He didn't say that hell was real. These are all twists, misrepresentations, leveled at, or in how Jesus is interpreted, or perhaps leveled at us. Facts don't matter. Don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up. The world and even some Christian leaders still get Jesus wrong. Because their words were twisted to satisfy their own desires. They had an agenda, and so we will just use Jesus' words to promote our agenda. Never mind that they're completely out of context and misrepresented. The fabrication of the testimony. Thirdly, the declaration from Jesus. The declaration from Jesus in verses 60 to 62. Through all this, Jesus remains silent. Why? He doesn't go, guys, excuse me. I didn't say that. You completely misinterpreted me. I meant in a spiritual sense. You just remain quiet. I've been in places like that myself, kind of a mob meeting, and didn't say anything. Why not? What's that going to do? Their minds are already made up. This is mob thought. That's why they arrested him. Now they're just finding a way to legitimize it. This is completely irrational. Jesus knows. You can't speak rationality into irrational. They're thinking with their feelings, you might say. You can't engage in a rational conversation here. This is simply driven by hatred. They hate him. Verse 60. The high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? What do you have to say for yourself?" But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asks, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Referring to God the Father. It's actually In the emphatic, and in the original language, the first word in that question is you. You are the Christ, the Son of the Blessed. Jesus finally speaks. We don't have time to turn there this morning, but he's combining Daniel 7:13 and Psalm 110:1 together. Daniel 7:13, Psalm 110, verse 1. He's quoting scripture again. Now, it's interesting. His first words are, I am. Yeah, it means, yeah. But it also means, for those of you unfamiliar with the Greek language, that in the original Greek language is the two words, ego emi. Very simple. E-G-O-E-M-I. Ego I, emi, it is I. It's a compound meaning I am. Remember Moses in the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3? And he meets Yahweh, and Moses asks Yahweh what his name is so he can go tell the people. And God reveals himself, and he calls himself, he says, I am that I am. The term in the Hebrew is Yahweh. But if you go to the Greek translation of the Hebrew in that place, it doesn't use the word Yahweh, it uses the Greek equivalent, and it says, ego eimi, I am that I am. That's the name of God. And I don't think it would pass, should pass us by. And when Jesus answers the question that is put to him by the high priest, are you the Christ, the Son of the Beloved? And he answers, I am. Cloaked, meaning he is God. And he goes on to say, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. There. Though they dishonor him, God, he says, my Father will exalt me. He will vindicate me. I could go on about that, but let's go on to 4, the condemnation by the council. The condemnation by the council. What do they do? Verse 63, and the high priest said, you must have that wrong, Jesus. Let's have a conversation about this. What do you mean? I don't understand. What does he do? He tears his garment. What? Why would you tear your jacket? Well, for those who say Jesus never claimed to be God, the high priest didn't think so. He had no doubt as to the claim of Jesus. Tearing the garment was a signal that a priest would demonstrate when a person was blaspheming. That's what that's about. Verse 64, show you that I'm not making it up. You have heard his blasphemy. The reason is very clear. Jesus claimed divinity, equality with God. I am. You will see the Son of Man. That's a phrase out of Daniel referring to Messiah. It is a term of supernatural divinity. Seated at the right hand of power, he's at the right hand of God, coming with the clouds of heaven. What does that represent? Divinity. God followed the Israelites in the cloud. It has all kinds of implications of a divine authority. There is no doubt what Jesus is saying. So if they come to your door two by two and they don't believe Jesus is God, we'll take them here. He is then, in verse 65, mocked for his prophetic words. He is ridiculed. He is beaten. And this is what you would do to a blasphemer. Spit on him. So this trial isn't off to a very good start. The spiteful priest, and this is led by the high priest, and they all agree, who damns him. Secondly, the fearful disciple who denies him. The fearful disciple who denies him. And simply two things. One, we have a threefold renouncement. Threefold renouncement in verses 66 to 71. The scene now focuses to Peter. Verse 66. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You were also with the Nazarene Jesus." In John's account, Peter is there because another one of the disciples, probably John, had connections with the high priest's office and got Peter in with this servant girl leading the way. That's sort of a side story here. So here he sits, warming himself. "You're one of his men." 68, but he denied it. "I don't know, and I don't understand what you mean." "What do you mean, I'm one of his men?" Verse 69, it happens again. Except this time, others are included. The servant's girl saw him again, and she said, began to say, to the bystanders. So it's not just her now, where he's trying to just keep it quiet. Now there's others involved in this accusation. This man is one of them, but again, he denied it. Second denial. But again, he denied it, and after a little while, the bystanders now again said to Peter, now it's the whole mob, "Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." Now, why did they think that? Matthew tells us that he spoke with a Galilean accent. Like, this morning there was somebody here from Ireland. Well, you're Irish, right? Or you're Dutch, or you're Brazilian. We can all tell by the accent. Now, I guess if you're British, you think Canadians have an accent, but we won't go down that road. But they can tell. I only have to go to Bellingham, and I can tell you that the Americans have a slightly little different... Well, that's how they say, "No, you're a Galilean." Verse 71, Peter doubles down. He began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." It wasn't that he wasn't with him. Now he doesn't know him. And he invokes God's curse on himself. It's like going to court and putting your hand on the Bible and saying, "I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. By God, I don't know him." He's adamant, probably using a few choice four-letter words that I will not use. Mark 14:29. Peter says to Jesus, even though they all fall away, I will not. And Jesus said, truly, I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he said emphatically, Peter's always emphatic about everything. If I must die with you, I will not deny you. Guess Jesus was right. How does this happen? This is only a few hours. Mark 14, 37. Remember the garden? And he came, that is Jesus, and he found his disciples sleeping. And he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. That's how. How many times was Peter found sleeping? Three. How many denials? One denial for each nap. We mentioned Peter's self-confidence. Not me. But his intense affirmation was only matched by his intense denials. Meant well. But he was sleeping when he should have been praying. I don't even have to apply that to our lives, right? You can do how much without me? Nothing. Now he denies Jesus. Now, lest we try to make excuses for Peter, or for ourselves, because that's why we'll make excuses for him, I quote, it is the fashion nowadays to make excuses for Peter as some do for Judas, and in so far it means that we see our own weaknesses in him. That may be good. But unless we see the seriousness of his sin, we cannot understand the bitterness of his remorse. He went out and what? Wept bitterly. Nor the depths of his repentance, nor the grace of his restoration. Our task is not to analyze by what easy steps Peter's fall came, but to realize the terrible nature of it. He denied his Lord. Further. The whole account of Peter's fall develops stage by stage until Peter has passed the point of no return. His rash self-confidence and scorn of others, his failure to discipline himself in the garden, his panic and flight, his following at a distance, his close association with the enemies of Jesus, all these in turn made the actual denial the logical and indeed most inevitable result. No doubt Peter was sincere in his initial desires and protestations, but the battle against temptation in the high priest's palace had been long lost before. The time for a Christian to fight temptation is before it is encountered. Read that again. The time for the Christian to fight temptation is before it is encountered. The game is won or lost, the game is won or lost on the practice field more than in the game itself. The strength comes in the training, not in the actual match. Lesson. Peter is grieved by his actions. Now, it's very interesting that if you go to the Gospel of Matthew, the immediate story that follows the denial of Peter is the suicide of Judas. Two failures There are two kinds of grief. They both grieved. Sorrow for what you have done, and sorrow for how it turned out. One undoubtedly looks inside, and the other one blames somebody else, but it didn't go right. This is godly sorrow and worldly sorrow. 2 Corinthians 7:10, if you want to cross-reference it. Not all sorrow leads to repentance. For Judas, it led to his self-execution, his hanging of himself. We are to be sorrowful, not for what happened, but we're to be sorrowful for the fact that we are ourselves to blame and are sorry for it. And there's good news for Peter coming. For Peter, there was a way back. There's always a way back, even from the greatest denials. For Jesus appears after his resurrection first to which disciple? Peter. And he restores him in John 21. How many times does he ask Peter if he loves him? One for each denial. Restores him. Failure doesn't have to be the end, for he knows our weaknesses. He actually predicted it. The spiteful priest who damns him, the fearful disciple who... we missed one, didn't we? A threefold renouncement. You want to know what that is, right? Oh, where am I here? Lost my notes. It's page 4. Hold on. That's wrong. Page 3. I'm trying to figure out why I missed it. Threefold renouncement. We've already talked about it. Threefold renouncement, a twofold announcement. Let me just say a few things about that. What happens after Peter denies him for the third time? The rooster announces twice that it's time to wake up. In Luke 22:61, it says that Jesus, as after he denied him and the rooster crowed for the second time, it says that Jesus looked at him. That must have been quite a look. A look of what? I told you. Disappointment. Sorrow. Love. Right. When I was a kid, sometimes my dad would look at me. Or my mom. Now look at me. Look sometimes is worth 1,000 words. All right, we already talked about why he fell. The spiteful priest who damns him, the fearful disciple who denies him. Now, thirdly, the woeful governor who delivers him. The woeful governor who delivers him. And this will be quick. One, we have the interrogation of Jesus in verses 1 to 5. The interrogation of Jesus. Mark abbreviates the whole political trial. There's no reference to Herod involved here. You have to go elsewhere to find that. Just as he left Annas out, he leaves out Herod. Here, Jesus is simply delivered to Pilate, the governor, because they had the jurisdiction over execution. The Jews couldn't stone him. They weren't allowed. They had to go through Rome. But the sentence, and I would also have you note that the Sanhedrin does not come with a religious accusation of blasphemy. They come with a political one of insurrection. He claims to be king. Because Pilate couldn't give a rip if he claimed to be God. He just doesn't want him to be king. So they play the death card. Pilate asks him the very same question that the high priest asked him. Are you the king? That's not tolerated. That's a threat to Rome. Jesus answers with the emphatic, you say so. But in fact, he was. Verses 3 to 5, there are more accusations. Again, Jesus is silent. Isaiah 53, 7, we read it this morning. As a lamb goes before its shears is silent, so you open not his mouth. He's fulfilling prophecy. More accusations, he's silent. Pilate is absolutely amazed. And again, there are things missing here. His dialogue with Jesus, his wife's dream, who says, don't have anything to do with this man. That's in Matthew. He finds Jesus innocent. The interrogation of Jesus. Secondly, the emancipation of Barabbas. The emancipation of Barabbas, 6 to 14. Pilate is in a bind. He knows Jesus is innocent. The other Gospels tell us so. He declares, I have final fault in this man. But the pressure from the religious establishment is profound. His job requires a degree of peace in his jurisdiction. He can't have riots always taking place. Then they're going to put somebody else in as governor. So it was a last gasp attempt. It was a custom to release a prisoner as a gesture of goodwill for the Jews. So he puts Jesus out there as bait. Maybe he's got enough followers here who will go for that and will get out of this mess. Well, if this king had supporters, but probably there were none there. They talk about, you know, they welcomed him on Sunday and then they yelled crucified him on Thursday. That sounds really kind of good to preach, but it's probably not what happened. It's probably a very different crowd. The welcome, remember, it's 2 in the morning. Well, now it's early in the morning. It's 6 in the morning when they held the trial. They're sleeping. They're getting ready for Passover. This is a rent-a-crowd. These are the supporters who want to know what's happening with Jesus. Again, Pilate knows he's innocent and grasps the real reason for this problem, and he says it was because they were envious. He had supporters, he had followers, and they were made to look foolish. It's a complete travesty now for Pilate. Because Barabbas probably had some backers there who wanted him released, and with the inciting of the priests, it just makes it worse. Verse 11, the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have him released for them, Barabbas instead, and Pilate again said to them, then what shall I do with the man you call the king of the Jews? And they cried out, yeah, he's your king, crucify him. Said to him, what evil has he done? He knows there's nothing. Crucify him. Mob rule. And verse 15 already alluded to this, the motivation of Pilate. The only way out is to give in to the mob. So he knowingly sentences an innocent man. Why? To protect his own interests. He's really no different from the priests. He knows that he's going to be in trouble if there's an uprising about this, or he doesn't do something about a king. He's protecting his own interests. What are the priests doing? They're protecting their own interests. That's why people want nothing to do with Jesus, because your interests are at stake. Yeah, they are. But you have to if you want to hold on to your interests, really. It's an irony here. And so Barabbas is released. When there's a type there, that's a whole sermon in itself. Jesus dies probably on the cross that was for Barabbas. He represents all of mankind. And Jesus is flogged. We'll talk more about that next week. Many a man died under the flogging itself. And then it says, they delivered him to be executed. That's an interesting phrase, and I want to close with a parallel phrase in Acts chapter 2 and verse 23. They delivered him to be executed. Is Jesus the simple victim of political and religious extremism and events? Were they delivered him to be executed? Acts 2:23, this same Peter is now preaching, and he says, this Jesus delivered, same word, delivered up by you, no, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. Yes, they had their hand in it, the Jews, the Romans. But the ultimate person who delivered him up, who allowed this to take place, was God. For you and for me. The crucifixion next week.